Welcome to Audio Notes. This is Dmitry Atapin, your guide for today through the exploration of the second Carte Blanche concert of our 2025 season, featuring violinist Benjamin Beilman and pianist Gloria Chen. Together, they will present a joyous and exciting program with works by Isaïe, Tartini, Paganini, Schubert, Rogerson, and Franck. Of course, there is a fascinating web of connections that unite these compositions, and we ask the violinist Benjamin Beilman to speak with us and share with us the inspiration behind the choice of these particular works for the performance.
I was inspired to come up with the pieces for this recital program because of the instrument that I am very, very lucky to play on. I have the Isaïe Guarneri del Gesù from 1740, on loan to me from a wonderful Japanese foundation, the Nippon Music Foundation. This instrument is one of the most legendary violins in all of history. It was obviously used by Eugène Isaïe, Isaac Stern. I believe Yehudi Menuhin also played on it for a brief stint. Pinchas Zukerman. It's got a long lineage of some of the most incredible players in its history. And then, of course, there are some very important pieces that have been written for the violinists who have played this instrument. So since my loan is a finite term, my loan has been extended for another year or so that I can play these recitals, actually. I basically just said, I have to play these pieces. What pieces must I play before I no longer have the use of this violin that gave voice to these pieces for the first time? So Eugène Isaïe, for whom the violin is titled, was a wonderful Belgian virtuoso from the late 1800s, early 1900s. At various points in his career, he was the concertmaster of the earliest version of the Berlin Philharmonic. He was a wonderful conductor. He was, I believe, the music director of the Cincinnati Symphony for about three seasons in the United States. He was a string quartet leader of the famous Isaïe Quartet. Debussy wrote a string quartet for the Isaïe Quartet for Mr. Isaïe. He was a composer. He was the private violin tutor of the Queen of Belgium. He was given a state funeral upon his passing in Belgium. And he was the dedicatee of the Franck Violin Sonata. César Franck, of course, wonderful composer. Also from Belgium and working mostly in Paris, wanted to honor and thank Mr. Isaïe for being such a huge champion of his music early on. And so on the morning of Isaïe's first wedding, and I believe it was 1886, Franck sent his now world-famous violin sonata to Isaïe as a wedding gift. So knowing that this important work was given life through my violin, I had to play on the recital. And then thinking about that kind of relationship between the violin, between Mr. Isaïe and also Mr. Franck, I was really inspired by how do violinists and how do composers all inspire each other. Of course, there's Paganini, who's perhaps the most famous or infamous violin virtuoso of all time, supposedly possessed by the devil because of all of his technical prowess. Tartini was a composer and also a violinist himself. And then, of course, there's Schubert, there's Isaïe's own works. One of his solo sonatas opens the program. So this program is an exploration of kind of that holy trinity of composers, violinists, and their instruments.
Thank you, Ben. Let us delve into the concert itself. The performance will open with Eugène Isaïe's solo violin sonata number 3. Born in 1858 in Liège, Belgium, Isaïe was widely regarded as the greatest violinist of his time. His exceptional technique and profound expressivity significantly enriched the violin repertoire in the early 20th century, earning him the nickname the King of the Violin, or simply the Tsar. Over 200 works were dedicated to him, including compositions by Debussy, Chasson, Franck, and Saint-Saëns. Alongside his extensive performance career across Europe, Isaïe was also a composer, conductor, and influential teacher at his alma mater, the Brussels Conservatory, beginning at the early age of 28. Among Isaïe's compositions, the most celebrated are his 6 solo violin sonatas from 1924, each dedicated to an eminent violinist, many of whom were his own students. Each sonata captures the unique playing style of its dedicatee while highlighting virtuosity and expressive depth, pushing the violin's technical boundaries. Let's hear from violinist Benjamin Beilman again as he shares his thoughts on this sonata and why he chose it as the opening piece on the concert.
Since the germ of the idea of this program is Mr. Izai, fortunately, he wrote six wonderful virtuoso solo violin sonatas, loosely modeled after Bach's six sonatas and partitas for violin. And in choosing the one to open the program, I wanted to choose the most compact, the one that I find to be the most musically interesting, but also character exploration is the most broad, in my opinion, and the least academic. This is his third sonata, the Ballade, which he dedicated to the Romanian virtuoso and composer, George Enescu. It's about 8.5 minutes. It starts from essentially nothingness, as tranquil as possible, and then you speed up to this feverish, devilish dance by the end, which, as one would expect of any virtuoso, it really puts the violinist through his paces. You've got tenths, you've got incredibly quick running notes. You have to have incredible bow control and lots of kind of rhythmic verve. I thought as a way to grab the audience and to sort of plant a flag on the stage and say, this is what we're doing here. This is about Izai. This is about what violinists can do and what violins allow violins to do.
The third sonata, titled Ballade, consists of a single continuous movement that begins with a slow, recitative-like introduction. As Benjamin Beilman mentioned, this introductory section gradually builds tension, giving way to vibrant, technically demanding passages featuring rapid scales, intricate double stops, and powerful chords that fully utilize the violin's expressive capabilities. Here's another little example. Rich with contrasting dynamics and emotional intensity, the sonata creates an atmosphere that is at once passionate and profoundly reflective, while elevating the power of a single violin to a truly symphonic scale. It is only fitting that after this dramatic planting of the violinistic flag, next on the program is the sonata by the Italian violinist and composer Giuseppe Tartini, famously known by its tremor-inspiring nickname, the Devil's Trill. Born in 1692 in present-day Slovenia, Tartini grew up in a town that was then part of the Venetian Republic. Reflecting the Baroque period's emphasis on the violin as the paramount solo instrument established by predecessors such as Arcangelo Corelli and Antonio Vivaldi, Tartini significantly shaped violin pedagogy through his influential violin school. His extensive writings on violin technique and theory later informed even Leopold Mozart's renowned violin textbook. Tartini was not only a phenomenal teacher, but also a virtuoso of awe-inspiring capabilities and a prolific composer for his instrument. In total, Tartini composed over 300 works, and the Devil's Trill Sonata remains his most enduringly famous piece. Let's hear again from violinist Benjamin Beilman as he shares his insights into the intriguing story behind this work and its evocative title.
Supposedly, the story goes that Giuseppe Tartini had a very vivid dream or a nightmare one night where he was visited by the devil himself. The devil came to his bedside and basically said, I will teach you the violin. I will teach you how to play as wonderfully or as terrifyingly as me. And of course, Tartini accepted this Faustian bargain. And by the end of it, the devil agreed to perform for Mr. Tartini. And of course, Tartini supposedly says that the performance that the devil gave is his version of this quote unquote devil's trill sonata. He was so possessed. The trills were so terrifying. They were so mesmerizing. He woke up in a fever and tried furiously to recapture some of the brilliance of the devil in his performance. And, you know, this is, in Tartini's words, the poor recreation of that sonata.
Now for the sonata itself. It comprises three distinct movements. The opening movement introduces a gentle lilting lullaby. Afterwards, it transitions into a crisp and spirited allegro, characterized by agitated, energetic rhythms. The final movement alternates between reflective, dreamy passages and dazzling bravura displays, offering a synthesis of the moods from earlier movements. Notably, the last allegro features the iconic Devil's Trill passage, a dramatic rising sequence of double stops punctuated by virtuosic trills on the upper strings. Let's hear again from Benjamin Beilman as he further discusses the complexities and charm of these passages.
What I love about this piece, especially besides the trills, which you'll hear in the third movement, there are these sort of little cadenzas. Fritz Kreisler, a wonderful, less possessed violinist from Vienna, made his own arrangement of this sonata. So he brought it into modern ears and enhanced, supposedly, the devil's trill element to it. There's an extended cadenza towards the very end of the piece that is purely Fritz Kreisler. So I love that Giuseppe Tartini had his version. And then, of course, we have a slightly more modern violinist adding to it as well.
Of course, every recital that aspires to be a violinistic showcase must feature music by Niccolò Paganini, the legendary Italian violin virtuoso and composer born in 1782, celebrated for his dazzling technique and almost supernatural mastery of the instrument. Let's hear once more from Benjamin Beilman about Paganini's profound influence on violin playing and his role in the history of the violin.
Niccolò Paganini, the Italian virtuoso of the 1800s, was known, or he was believed to essentially be possessed by the devil. People would see him perform. He could do feats on the violin that nobody could have possibly imagined before. They theorized that maybe his joints were looser than anybody else's. His fingers were longer. His hair was long, black, and slick back. And apparently Mr. Paganini had a penchant for gambling. So basically people believe that no human could achieve what he has on the violin.
Though Paganini is often associated with fiery, technically demanding compositions, the Cantabile in D major, composed between 1823 and 1826, shows us a different facet of his artistry. A deeply lyrical, expressive piece highlighting the violin's singing qualities. Cantabile, Italian for singing, aptly captures the essence of this exquisite gem. It unfolds gently, its melody reminiscent of an elegant bel canto aria. The violin line floats gracefully above a delicate piano accompaniment, evoking warmth, nostalgia, and serene beauty. Paganini's flowing, arching phrases and subtle ornamentation invite the listeners to fully explore the operatic depth of the singing violin tone. Benjamin Beilman describes this beautifully.
What I actually love about Paganini, listening to his caprices and some of his string quartets and his guitar music, he has an incredible command of the sort of bel canto line. So I thought, we know Paganini can do technique. Let's show off Mr. Paganini in his most singing, most beautiful, simplest version. And so this is a short little piece. It's a cantabile. I'm sure it's a piece that he maybe played as an encore several times. You know, it's a 5-minute piece that just is... it's all about love. You can just imagine a violinist and a guitarist perhaps singing under a windowsill or something. So yeah, the Paganini Cantabile and the Schubert Rondo Brilliant to me are inseparable because they clearly inspired each other.
And speaking of Franz Schubert, he remains one of the most beloved composers of the early 19th century. He was renowned for his exceptional gift for melody and his ability to infuse even instrumental works with profound lyricism, most likely derived from his propensity for composing innumerable lieder or songs. While Schubert's name isn't typically linked to virtuoso violin music, his Rondo Brillant in B minor, composed in October 1826, makes a compelling argument for that connection. This brilliant showpiece was reportedly written to showcase the dazzling talents of the young Czech violinist Josef Slavik, whom Chopin famously hailed as a second Paganini. Just a year later, Slavik would also inspire Schubert's famously demanding fantasy for violin and piano. Here is Benjamin Beilman reflecting on the spirit of Paganini's virtuosity and its influence on Schubert's writing.
Paganini gave many tours around Europe and inspired many, many different composers in terms of what was possible in their instruments. He also inspired Mr. Schubert. Franz Schubert heard some of his performances in the 1820s in Vienna. They were sold out, essentially circus shows. And I think in hearing Mr. Paganini and learning what was possible on the violin, he decided in his last years of composing to really stretch the technique that he asked of violinists in their pieces. You know, we have his fantasy, we have many of the string quartets that make the violinist fly around the fingerboard in ways that he had never really asked for before. And what I love is this Rondo Brilliant, which will close the first half, is sort of Paganini's influence on Mr. Schubert. We have Schubert's incredible use of melody and of harmonic development with all of the spellbinding technique from the violin and the piano.
The Rondo Brillante unfolds in two main sections, an imposing andante introduction, followed by a lively allegro rondo. The introduction opens dramatically, with the piano proclaiming double-dotted rhythms reminiscent of a Baroque French overture, answered by dazzling violin runs that shoot into the upper register. But Schubert quickly transforms the scene. The violin introduces a serene, plaintive melody floating gently over an undulating piano accompaniment. The Allegro, set in a spirited 4/4 meter, unveils the playful rondo theme, brimming with rhythmic energy and lively interplay between violin and piano. Throughout the movement, Schubert leads us through a kaleidoscope of episodes, alternating sparkling technical fireworks with tender lyrical moments, allowing both instruments to shine. There are airy, folk-like dance sections, square, march-like passages, and moments that remind us of Schubert's unrivaled gift for crafting simple yet exquisite serene melodies, like in this example. Now let us hear from Benjamin Beilman on what he finds particularly remarkable about the piece.
What I find so amazing is that in typical Schubert form, he extends the ideas just to the point where you think that they might break. You think that the audience might get sick of this. He's going to repeat this rondo. He's returning to the same material over and over and over again in just a slightly different key, slightly transformed. And just when you think as an audience member that you can't handle it anymore, he always has this slight wink in composition where he makes you think about this material in a completely different way. And that's when he begins to leave it. It's like he says, okay, I know that you're sick of this. I know that we have exhausted the possible ideas. Let me just show you my genius one more time. I love that in the final return to the home rondo idea, you can sense a fatigue from the audience. And there's a moment where you go, instead of being in minor, you go to major, as if saying, it's okay, we're going home, the piece will conclude, I promise you, it has all been worth it.
And now, let's hear a thrilling excerpt just before the coda, capturing the full brilliance of Schubert's imagination. certainly a powerful moment to close the first half of this program. Onwards to the second half, which opens with Chris Rogerson's Air for Violin and Piano, a short, charming piece written specifically for Benjamin Beilman for a very special occasion.
The piece that begins the second half, Chris Rogerson's Air for Violin and Piano, has a very similar origin story to the Franck Violin Sonata. As I mentioned earlier, Isai was presented with a wonderful sonata by César Franck on the morning of his wedding. Chris Rogerson is one of my closest friends. He's been one of my closest friends for over 15 years and has also been probably my closest artistic collaborator. He's written a violin concerto for me. He wrote two other violin and piano pieces. I commissioned him for a solo violin work over the pandemic. I love his music. I find it to be some of the most touching, beautiful, sensitive stuff around. And fortunately, since he is my friend, I asked him to write a work essentially for my own wedding day. And he very, very respectfully and wonderfully obliged. And he wrote this piece essentially so that my wife could process down the aisle to this. As a kind of aside, if you're a musician getting married, one of the most fraught decisions you have to make is what music is going to be played at my wedding. And so, of course, you know, I picked some of my favorites, but I knew that I wanted Chris to write something for the festivities. And he wrote this piece originally for a kind of string ensemble. And it was very special. I teared up. But then I thought, you know, I don't want it to only live in this form as a wedding present. I want also to be able to play it going forward. So I asked him to arrange this piece for violin and piano, and he extended it, he expanded it. And it's, in my opinion, I think it's a perfect sort of entree to the harmonic labyrinth that begins the Franck Violin Sonata.
And after this charming introduction, we travel into the final work of the program, closing this monumental carte blanche, the grandiose sonata for violin and piano in A major by César Franck. Franck, the Belgian-born composer, pianist, and organist, left an indelible mark on 19th-century French music. As a revered professor at the Paris Conservatoire, he influenced an entire generation of composers, including Vincent Dundee, Paul Dukas, and Ernest Chausson, particularly through his use of cyclic form and bold harmonic exploration, hallmarks that shaped French music well into the 20th century. Composed in 1886 as a wedding gift for the celebrated Belgian violinist Eugène Isaïe, from whom we already heard at the very beginning of this recital, and who was 36 years Franck's junior, this sonata quickly became a cornerstone of the violin-piano repertoire. Here is Benjamin Beilman reflecting on its timelessness and significance.
The Franck Sonata is perhaps one of the most well-known violin, or I should say string sonatas. Cellists very often borrow this piece, as do flutists, sometimes violists. And there's a reason for it. It's sort of the most perfectly constructed in four perfect movements. They all lead into each other. They all borrow motifs and ideas and pacing from each other. And it also asks sort of the full capacity of both the pianist and the string or flute player. In terms of technique and expression and color, it's sort of the perfect representation of what an artist can and should be.
The sonata is a masterful example of cyclic form, where earlier themes reappear and transform across movements, creating a sense of organic unity. It unfolds across four movements. The opening Allegretto ben moderato introduces a tender, reflective melody, evoking a serene warmth. This lyrical violin line sets the thematic foundation for the entire work.
Thank you.
A second theme, given to the piano, feels almost like a delicate interlude, exploring distant tonalities. As Benjamin Beilman notes,
the first movement I love so much because it really does feel like it's discovering itself throughout the entire movement. You know, this piece is on paper written sort of in A major. You'd expect it to fall in that line. But Mr. Franck, he doesn't really give you A major at the very beginning. It really does feel like you're circling it. You're nearby. You can sense its presence, but you begin in B minor, this key that should have nothing to do with A major, essentially. And throughout, you know, this perfect kind of sonata form representation, this idea that you have opening music, you develop it, you return to the opening material, and then you have a kind of coda. You're searching for where is home, what feels good, basically, between the violin and piano. It's a simple kind of lilting. It should feel like a kind of slow dance of sorts. And then there are moments where the piano takes over, has a little cadenza. To me, it's a perfect representation of harmonic development and uncertainty.
Yes, the first movement balances lyricism, uncertainty, and restraint, allowing its simplicity to unfold with graceful naturalness. In sharp contrast, the second movement, Allegro in D minor, erupts with fiery drama and rhythmic urgency. Let us hear from Benjamin Beilman again.
The second movement is essentially just virtuoso from the very outset. It emerges from the kind of nothingness that ends the first movement. The piano begins with this kind of rumbling in the nether regions of the piano. It's a conversation back and forth, but it really is an argument. It's fortissimo. It's appassionato. It's all these things that really just reek of passion.
The piano unleashes a restless, impassioned theme while driving forward with turbulent energy. Lyrical second theme offers a brief respite. Yet the storm returns shortly after. The charge and drama are palpable throughout, yet the movement closes in a brilliant D major. This movement demands virtuosic brilliance from both players, with rapid arpeggios, double stops, and dramatic dynamic shifts for the violin, and relentless rhythmic drive and incessant passage work for the piano. Passion and tumult are its staples. In a fitting change of scenery from the second movement, the third movement, Recitativo Fantasia, is mysterious, improvisatory, and almost rhapsodic. Now let us hear again from Benjamin Beilman with a description.
The third movement begins with a kind of rough approximation of the music that we heard in the very opening of the first movement, but with the knowledge of what has already happened. The piano begins, and then the violin takes over with its own little cadenza, but it sort of fades away very quickly. It doesn't go on with pride. It starts from a place of confidence and very quickly evaporates.
Its piano introduction subtly recalls the opening of the first movement, now in a darker chromatic light. The violin then takes on an almost vocal role, weaving a narrative line. As the movement unfolds, it traverses a wide harmonic landscape, flowing seamlessly between keys and emotional states. It closes with an unexpected harmonic shift, leaving a sense of quiet evaporation. The final movement, Allegro Poco Mosso, bursts forth in joyful, radiant triumph. Frank introduces a radiant, lyrical theme that the violin and piano immediately present in strict canon, meaning the violin states the melody and the piano answers or imitates the exact same melody shortly after, like a musical echo chasing itself. What's remarkable is how seamless and natural this imitation feels. Listen in. Do you hear it? It's not presented as a dry exercise, but as a flowing, organic conversation filled with warmth and optimism. An incredible example of how contrapuntal procedures are used for a musical purpose of reinforcement and delight, rather than simply as a skillful demonstration. Benjamin Beilman agrees.
Fourth movement, it begins with one of the greatest, most extensive canons in all of music. A canon is where one person begins the idea and a second person plays that exact same material just slightly later. Usually this is given to music students in conservatory. And, you know, if you're lucky, you can write maybe four bars of a canon without it becoming a complete hot mess. And Mr. Franck does it for something like 2 minutes. It's beautiful. It's triumphant. It's majestic. It sounds great on both instruments, I have to say. It's virtuosic without being the point of the whole piece. It's perfect.
It's perfect in more ways than one. Thematic material from the previous movements resurfaces, a hallmark of Franck's cyclic style. The composer weaves the serene sweetness of the first movement, the stormy drama of the second, and impassioned calls from the third into a unified, exhilarating whole. The exuberant coda rings out like celebratory church bells, delivering one of the most glorious and satisfying conclusions in the violin piano repertoire. A glorious conclusion indeed. From Eugène Ysaÿe all the way to today's greatest performers, countless artists have embraced this work as a profound vehicle for expressive storytelling and technical mastery. We can't wait to hear Benjamin Beilman and Gloria Chen bring their unique artistry to this masterpiece at the conclusion of the second Carte Blanche concert of the season. Let us hear once again with his final thoughts from Benjamin Beilman.
This recital calls on many different eras of music and different types of playing, and there are very few collaborators in the world that I would ask to do this with or who would be up to the challenge. And very fortunately for me, in the Menlo family, and one of my dear friends, Gloria Chen, has agreed to play everything from Paganini Cantabile to the Tartini Devil's Trill, all through the Mount Everest of the Franck Violin Sonata.
This concludes our discussion of the wonderful Carte Blanche with Benjamin Beilman and Gloria Chin. A special thank you to Amy Cota for her immense help in procuring the audio samples, to the organizations who provided access to their catalogs, and to the artists who agreed to share their thoughts on the music. I'm Dmitry Atapin, and I cannot wait to see you at the concert. Audio notes are written and produced by Dmitry Atapin and Heian Park in consultation with David Finkel and Wuhan. Many thanks to Benjamin Beilman for speaking with us for this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Ysaÿe Sonata No. 3 for solo violin ballade performed by James Thompson, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Tartini Sonata The Devil's Trill performed by Adam Burnett Hart Violin, Keith Robinson Cello, and Heian Park Harpsichord, courtesy of Music at Menlo Life. Schubert Rondo Brillant performed by Sean Lee Violin and Gloria Chien Piano, courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Franck Sonata for Violin and Piano performed by Arnaud Zussman Violin and Orion Weiss Piano, courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.